and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around at the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today's guest is someone I've known many years through the New Jersey chapter of the Entrepreneurs Organization, or EO as it's known. And he's somebody who spent decades working with growth-minded founders and leadership teams across a wide range of industries. I'm joined by Carl Gould, founder of Seven Stage Advisors. Carl works with owner-led companies at critical stages of growth, helping them navigate scale, leadership complexity, and the structural shifts required to move from entrepreneurial hustle to durable organizations. Over the years, a meaningful portion of the companies he's advised have been family-governed business-to-business organizations, which brings a unique set of dynamics into the work. Legacy, relationships, control, and continuity layered on top of growth strategy. Today, we're going to explore Carl's perspective on what changes when a business is also a family system, when things tend to break down, and what leaders can do to scale without damaging trust or long-term viability. Carl, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Hey, thanks, Ed. Great to be here.
Awesome, awesome. Hey, so Carl, you work with many different types of owner-led companies. When a business is family-run, what immediately changes in how you approach the work?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, even though there might not be blood in every family, almost every business has some family dynamic. But here's the first thing that changes. Now, one, you know, it's on paper, it's a great idea to work with your family. Who else would you want to support? Who else would you want to be around all the time? And you say, wow, wouldn't this be amazing? We can have this legacy business and we can all be around each other all the time. Wouldn't that be great? You know, and it's great right up until it's not. And but one of the things that changes immediately is accountability. Right, it's the first thing that is sacrificed. You can't. I'm sorry. You're not going to Thanksgiving dinner and doing singing Kumbaya and then holding somebody accountable the next Monday on the sales meeting because they didn't make as many calls. You're not going to punish them financially because of it. It's just almost never works. And so a family run business really struggles with accountability first and foremost.
So when you're entering a family-governed business and you're seeing that as an issue, how do you bring that up? Like, how do you address that?
Well, the first thing that I'll say is, they'll say, we need a better culture. They'll talk about two things. They'll talk about culture, and they'll talk about accountability. And they'll say, the reason someone would hire me is, over the last 3 years, their revenue might be flat, or profit might be flat, even though revenue might be growing. Or they're trying to go to the next level. They use up all of their ideas, what they're trying is not working, and they say, you know what, maybe we just need somebody from the outside looking in. Mm-hmm. And that's fair enough. That's all businesses, whether they're family run or not. That's a good reason to bring in any advisor. Bring in a hitting coach if what you're trying is not working. So I'll get there. The first thing I'll do, though, and I'm almost always hired by the owner, whoever that is at the time, because the type of work that I do, most of the rank and file in the beginning, they feel like it's a threat. Oh no, you're coming in to bring in Neutron Carl, not Neutron Jack Welch, if you remember that, right? He comes in and fires everybody. But that's it. Change means I'm gone. And so usually when I'm hired, it's first done by the CEO, and it's a leap of faith because they're hiring me because they're saying what we're doing is not working. We've worked with industry experts. We sit right outside the industry so we can look down on it, and we're not in the jar so we can read the label, and we can provide really good outside perspective. So there you go. So they bring me in and they say, all right, we want to grow. Or we want to go to the next level. That's code for there are issues internal. Either there's some internal strife or there's a partnership issue or there's somebody who no longer aligns with the goals and there's just nothing you could do about it. You know, and so at this point, I've dealt with it so many times. First off, I remind the client that everything's confidential. I said, look, we could talk freely. And then I'll just say, all right, who's the issue? Who are we talking about? Who are we talking about specifically? And sometimes the owner will say, well, it's me. I'm the bottleneck. Okay, and that's fair enough because most owners become a bottleneck at some point or another. Doesn't mean they're the whole problem there. But they'll say, you know, I've got somebody about to come into the business or I bought somebody into the business and we had some initial vision, but it's not really working out. There will be some family dynamic or some personal dynamic that is no longer viable or aligned. So we have to learn that right away. Now, I am of the belief that if somebody in your organization is not performing to start with, it's not their fault. It's your fault as the leader. So I would say, listen, first things first, let's take 100% responsibility for the performance of our team. If they're not performing, let's assume it's us. We haven't given them the tools. We haven't given them the resources. We haven't given them the coaching or mentoring in order to be successful. So first things first, let's look in the mirror. And what do we need to provide them in order to be successful? And then let's put those things in place so that way there's no excuse later and it truly is their responsibility. So that's the first place I'll start typically.
Okay, interesting. So many, and this kind of leads into my next question, many family B2B companies in the early stages, they're going through instinct, you know, they're just seat of their pants. Mm-hmm. They're going through the ability to build great relationships, and then as it starts to build momentum, reputation. At what point does that early growth kind of drive start to either wane or become almost like a limitation versus an advantage? Like, when do they kind of hit that first wall? Yeah.
Depending on the type of company, but it's typically in that $3 to $5 million per year range. Now, this is common in all business, not just family business. And here's part of what the challenge is. But I'll take family business for starters. Two family members get together and say, let's do it. Whatever it is, let's do it. We're on. Game on. And like every business, we all start out as generalists in the business. We wear multiple hats. Well, you're pretty good with people, and you're in marketing. I'm pretty good with numbers. I'll take finance. Great. But who's going to move the pallets in the warehouse? Well, what's wrong with your arms and legs? That'll be both of us, right? And so we wear multiple hats, and then you can hustle your way to $3 to $5 million in almost any business. And just by sheer grit and determination, get there. And listen, $3 to $5 million is nothing to sneeze at. That's the top 4% of all businesses worldwide. That's a lot to be proud of. But you realize that you hit a wall pretty easily because there's only so much of you to go around. And what was working for you when you had $250,000 in revenue as opposed to $4.5 million in revenue, that's where you're getting stuck because you now need specialists. So you hit this pinch point in that $3 to $5 million range where having a bunch of generalists, nobody knows marketing well enough to know how to do Google ads. Mm. Nobody knows logistics well enough to get the best trucking and rates other than just calling around like, how much will you be? How much will you? Now, they don't know how to synchronize routes and you know, point of origin. It's not point of destination, it's point of origin that almost always reduces your shipping. So they don't know a lot of these things, and they're scrambling. And they're generalists in almost all areas, so that means there are challenges in almost all areas. So all of us being entrepreneurial and scrappy, while those are good attributes, they're not good techniques when you get to 3 to 5 million.
Interesting. So I think this also leads to my next question. I mean, you certainly talk a lot about, and you're talking about it now, the stages of growth, right?
Yeah.
So why would you say that sometimes family-run businesses struggle maybe more than others with the whole point of like recognizing that, hey, our current mode of operating is no longer working. We've outgrown it or we're at a point where it's not sustainable. Why do they sometimes have a hard time coming to terms with that?
Well, the hard reality is if you were to fire everybody in a family-run business and make them reapply for their job, many of them wouldn't get it. They wouldn't get the job.
Sure.
Right? We had a client once where I remember sitting down with the family and there was a young woman that was part of the family and she was in-house counsel. And I said, oh, well, how did you end up as in-house counsel? She goes, oh, I went to law school.
And I'm like, oh, well, okay, well, that makes perfect sense. I said, so you always wanted to be a lawyer? She said, oh, no, I was told to go to law school because we needed an in-house counsel. I don't really like being a lawyer, and I don't really want to be in-house counsel, but it's what we needed. And I said, are you kidding? And she was like, no. And she was heir apparent to the business, and she's extremely talented. She may have been the strongest of the leadership team altogether. But she was in a position she didn't want to be in because she was kind of felt obligated to do it because they needed it in business. So she was groomed to be in-house counsel. She's like a teenager, you know? And so what tends to happen is in family-run businesses, we assign a role based on convenience or need, not talent and skill and propensity for the job. And so, you know, we make people managers when they're not really managers. We put people in certain parts of the business because that's the opening that is there, and you do your best to try to match the, you know, skill set to what they're doing. But it's more important in that dynamic, it's more important that the person has a job and is busy than they can do the job, at least, you know, for the family survival, if you will. And so it's oftentimes very mismatched who's working in the business and where.
I've seen it firsthand. I mean, for about 10 years or so, maybe longer, my sister was our controller. My sister was a chemical engineer by background.
Right.
She got the job because she's really organized and she's good with numbers.
And then, you know, one day she came and said, yeah, this is not really, I don't want to do this anymore. And I said, okay.
Right. And bless her, how many years did she do it before telling you before that day? How many
years? It was, so probably at least, I'm going to say maybe 15, maybe 20. Right. I don't know.
Right. And she hated it probably for 2/3 of that time.
Yeah.
She did it for a decade. Yeah. Getting her teeth, wishing she wasn't in the role.
Happy ending, though, she went into a role that she loved and adored and built a career and retired happily.
Think about this for a second. If I were to say to you, okay, let's create the model of a high-growth business, good culture, and let's put that, assemble that, and let's take off. Would you have on the list multiple people who hate their role on that description of the business? It's wrong. So they do that evaluation, and as good as somebody can do the role, they're really a steward of the role. They're not a driver of the role.
That's very well said. That's very true.
I'm sure your sister did a good job because she has high standards and she's very good job.
Yeah.
Right, but she just didn't want the job. And it's hard to be like passionate about something that you can't stand.
100% true. One of the things that comes up a lot in this show is transition and what it takes. So as the outsider kind of looking in, Carl, you know, we look at a company that's, you know, founder-led, parent-led, looking to maybe go to that next generation of leadership. Where do you see success and failure there in terms of those businesses that do successfully transfer to that next generation, whether it be second or third or even fourth?
There is a fundamental guiding principle in coaching that you set goals based on what you can control. A good goal for me would be, I say about myself, I want to lose 5 pounds. That's a goal I can control. You know, it's personal to me. I'm in control. I can state it in the positive, and I can take action. Mm-hmm. A bad goal is, I want Ed to lose 5 pounds. I have no control over that. I don't even know if Ed wants to lose 5 pounds. I can't make him do it. And, you know, I would be miserable if my success or my happiness relies on somebody else doing something. I cannot tell you, Ed, how many times I sit down and I ask the family-led business, parent-led, where I say, what are your goals? Oh, to get Jimmy and Janie into the business. I'm like, did you ever ask Jimmy and Janie if they want in the business? Oh, they said that they want in the business. And I'm like, okay, let me ask them. Let me. And I remember having this conversation with a good friend recently, well, a few years ago. And he was talking about he's got 3 sons, 2. He's like, these 2 are coming into the business. And I had met the 2, I never met the 3rd. And I said, about the 2nd, I said, there is 0 chance he will come in the business. 0. He's like, oh, no, I've already talked to him. We've assigned him a role. I said, he's saying yes to appease his dad and his mom. Mm-hmm. But he will do it. And I said, I guarantee. I said, this one is so easy. There is no chance he wants part of this business. And it's got nothing to do with anything else, but he's just not passionate about it. And his interests lie in other areas. And it's just never going to be this business. And that was a hard pill to swallow because the parents forever were positioning this business as a legacy, multi-generation business. And as more options for what you can do in your life evolve, like, I hate to say it, but when you and I were younger, there weren't as many options. And there are like 10 things you could be. Well, today,
there's 10 things you can be today. Tomorrow, there's 10 more things you can be or do. And with technology and remote working, I mean, forget it. There's so many varied interests. Mm-hmm. The chances that your kids want your business is really low. It's really low. And that's a hard thing to swallow sometimes. If your heart was set on continuing the family business, I would make sure I knew truly what the kids wanted or anyone else wanted. There might be one or two. Let's say you have four kids. There might be one, maybe two that might want in. But the chances all four want in, almost nil.
Very true. So what happens, I mean, this is and I'm sure you've seen this scenario. Okay, it's not a conversation. It's actually happened. So that next generation is sitting now in the business, but by your observations, by all indications, they are not suited to take over.
Yep.
They are floundering in whatever role they're in, and it's just not going well. Yet, in some ways, the train left the station, and now you got to have a hard conversation to that CEO to say, you know, this plan you had.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Okay, smarty pants, what do we do there? So there is actually a path forward. And then let me do the path forward because
please,
the listeners right now are like, we have that situation and, you know, obligation or desire or whatever, we're here and we're not leaving. So whenever I evaluate a small business and I'm looking for a management style or scheme, if you will, for that company, it'll fall in one of two basic categories. And the first category is what we call the CEO model, where the owner is... takes the role of the CEO, and they orchestrate by delegating and putting strong people around them. They don't do the doing every day, but they orchestrate and they set policy and they manage and empower and enable, manage cash flow, look for growth opportunities. They're a true CEO. They're not a producer. Or we have what we call the LeBron James model, right? And the LeBron James model is this, and I know I'm going to spark some controversy here, and this is for another podcast, I'm sure. Well, LeBron James right now, I'm not going to say greatest of all time because that we have the whole Michael Jordan conversation. But LeBron James right now is pretty much the best player in the NBA, right? He's one of the best players, okay? But if you don't like LeBron James and you have somebody else in mind, he's
got it.
But everyone knows who LeBron James is, so I use LeBron James. You go with the LeBron James model. Well, you know what? They're never making another LeBron James. You know, you can't scale him, right? So what do you do with him, the best player on the court? Do you take the ball out of his hands? Make him CEO, put him on the sideline, and then have everybody else play? Or do you say, look, we have a generational talent here. Let's give him the ball, get the hell out of his way, get him some good support players, and then we'll put somebody else on the sideline to be the CEO and run the business. And so let's say we have somebody who's running the business, and they know that they're just not really the best person to be doing it. However, they can play a very useful role in the business.
Mm.
So here's what you do. You fire them from being the CEO. They're not good at it. They don't do it well. But let's say they're good at sales. Or let's say they're good in the warehouse. Or let's say they're good at finance. Or let's say they're good in operations or dispatch. Give them a job they're good at. Fire them from CEO and put a general manager CEO there. And that person, they get fired into their job. But they're also on the board to set policy because they're the owner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Put them up in the owner's box. Set policy. Do all the annual strategic planning, you know, the corporate objectives, then go back and do your job wherever that is, and then you have a general manager or CEO whose job is to, or president, whose job is to run the business. Mm-hmm. So if truly the family members are untouchable, you go with the LeBron James model. You find where they can be good producers within the system. They still are on the board because they're owners. Or put somebody else in there to run the business. There's that option. If they were to reapply for the CEO job, they probably wouldn't get it. There's almost no viable scenario where they stay in the CEO role and the business survives. It is so rare, and I'm usually the one that has to have that heart to heart. You know, like, I know you just hired me to advise your business, but guess who the first person we're firing is? You know, you can't do the role. We got to find a new role for you. And sometimes what we'll do is, you know, I love this when I see this in email signatures and I tell my clients, I'm like, you got to stop this because it shows you don't know what the role is. I love it when a small business owner says, I'm president, CEO, and founder. I said, those are two different, like president and CEO are two totally different jobs. I said, CEO is much more of the ambassador, sovereign, face of the company role. President is a lot more tactical. So if you're going to be CEO and there's no way around that, then let's hire a president. You know, let's hire a president. They'll run the day-to-day. We'll make them COO or VP of ops or something along those lines, GM, managing director, some managing partner, something along those lines. But get somebody in there who knows how to run the business, because you can't, you know. And that is that's a hard pill to swallow. But if they're bringing in somebody to give them guidance, there's a part of them that knows it's true. They just don't know how to exit gracefully with dignity and also reassure the company that they're on a good trajectory.
You know, I've seen this play out a few times where ultimately, and a lot of times that CEO, Carl, is not a family member. You know, they're an outside, you know.
Best of all worlds,
yeah.
If that's the case.
Yeah.
If you can get that CEO to take the job, because they, in all seriousness, they'll come in, and they, if they're a pro, they've been through situations like this, and they kind of know family dynamics. But if you can get that person who knows the dynamics and can come in and run the business, it's the best of all worlds, because they're emotionally neutral. They don't get caught up in the Thanksgiving Day baggage, the Easter or Hanukkah or family dinners. And, you know, they'll be invited to the barbecue now and again, but they're optional. They're not mandatory. Mm-hmm. And they can be a good voice of reason. And so from that standpoint, that's a very healthy hire. That's a really good point.
I've seen it work. I've also seen it not work. And I often wonder, and I'd love to get your perspective on this. So sometimes I think of it in the context of there's what I'll call a lifestyle business, and then I'll call like an enterprise business. There's a family. They're saying, we want growth. We want faster growth. We want to be bigger, what have you. Nobody is really qualified or equipped to step forward. We're going to bring a CEO or a president figure from the outside to take us to the next level, and they do that. And the person starts doing what? They start instituting a lot of change and investing a lot of money and starting to make moves towards, I'll call it Enterprise Island. Somewhere before halfway in flight, somebody on the governing team or the board gets spooked and says, well, this is making us feel uncomfortable. Next thing you know, that hired gun is out of a job, and suddenly they're retreating back to Lifestyle Business Island. So
yeah.
I don't know if you see it that way or how you see it, but I would love your perspective on that, when there's that sort of like, we want growth, but as soon as we go down the growth path, we get spooked and we retreat back to something that feels safe.
Yeah, in a lifestyle business and in many businesses, convenience wins out over commitment. You know, comfort wins out over commitment. Growth is insanely hard. It's relentless. And I get, this is the question I get all the time. So I get a client, CEO, 40, and they're 40 plus, which means they've been at this 10 years or more. And at some point, because they're always embarrassed to ask, at some point they'll pull me aside and they'll say, when does it get easier? Like, when does it, like, I've been at this a decade. I've been at this 20 years. I've been doing this, like, at what point do my close rates go up? Do the leads, like, does the brand kick in and people come to us? And I'm like, oh, you want the date? I got it. I said, never. Never. I said, it doesn't get any easier. This is a competitive sport, and everyone's out for your job, and it becomes more and more sophisticated and complicated to get the same result going forward. But that's why business, in many ways, especially in the entrepreneurial world, I love it so much, because you really do get out what you put in. Mm. And you can out-hustle somebody. They can be better at what you do, but you can beat them on that day, because I can get to that networking event 5 minutes before you. I could stay 10 minutes later. I can get that extra business card. I can get you. And there's always someone who's watching you that says, I think I can do it a little better. I can automate this. I can add a system there. I can put a little tweak on it, and I can do an end around, and I can get you. So we hear that all the time. Like and in a lifestyle business, you know, we have a client right now that's rolling up accounting firms. And I so feel for accountants right now, especially if they're over 50, because they thought, I've spent the last 25 years building up a book of business. I just want to ride it out. I don't want to change. I don't want to do all this online stuff, all this AI, this outsourcing. Like, and by the time they reach retirement age, their book of business will be decimated, because they just won't be able to keep pace. They just won't. And I so feel for them, because their entire life was leading towards that. I'm going to sell my practice for 1.2x annual revenue, and I know how much I'm going to make, and I bought the condo, and their retirement plans are flipped up, and they just don't have the energy to go through it. And so a lifestyle business, convenience and comfort will be the champion. And so they'll come back and they'll say, this growth is uncomfortable. You need to be committed if you're going to grow and scale. It's one of the world's greatest challenges, and it's almost one of the world's greatest rewards. If you can get a business to scale
you are unfairly and exponentially rewarded because you're in the top 4% of all businesses. You get to 10 million or more, it's less than 1% of the businesses on the planet are over 10 million in U.S. equivalent, $10 million. So you are unfairly rewarded if you get to $10 million or more. And, you know, you get market share you don't always deserve, and you get, you know, you get the benefit of the doubt when you don't always deserve, and, you know, your brand kicks in and all those things. You got to be committed. And there's, you know, it's a graveyard between 1 and 10 million because you've gotten to that point and you figure, okay. And I'm like, oh, no, it's time to turn the jets on again. There's no jet back there. There was before, but that was 20 years ago. I do feel for business owners because they really, really thought they once they got to a certain point, they could coast. And they realized that you don't always have to work harder, but you do have to be more clever. You have to have intellectual property. Your how has to be as compelling as your why. You know, how you do things, your secret sauce, your differentiation, those elements that you need to put in place, or you're simply another Me Too business that can be ripped off way too easily, you know? And so I feel for them, but it's, you know, it was their choice, you know?
Yeah. So a lot of times in the background of that company that is maybe going through growth or has had just long-term success or long-term viability, you know, you see a lot of often non-family, sometimes family, but often non-family members who are, I'll call them highly tenured personnel. And I think sometimes, because one of the greatest strengths of a family-governed business is that huge attention and TLC put behind relationships.
Right.
I think a lot of times they're attracted to private equity because they say, wow, they've had clients, they've been with them for 10, 20 plus years, you know, they're unstoppable, you know, they're across generations, they have these deep, but sometimes, you know, we see, and you've probably seen this too, where in these long-held relationships, sometimes loyalty is confused for performance, or maybe loyalty is put higher in importance than performance. And sometimes, you know, the people that got us here, even though they've been with us for a really long time and they're very loyal,
yeah,
don't have the skills or ability or the performance capability to get us there. And that leads to some really, really hard conversations. You know, you got to tell somebody that's maybe been with you for 10 or 15 or maybe 20 years that you no longer have a place on the team. So yeah. Talk about that for a minute, if you would.
Yeah, so it is. Now, this will sound like bad news. And this will sound like a hard conversation for the owner. Mm-hmm. But I'd encourage all the listeners right now to think of this as a liberating part of the process. Because as business owners, we oftentimes want things for our employees that they don't want for themselves. You know, like a good example is, you know, ask anybody who's got a 401k plan in a small business. And like, they don't maximize their returns. They don't put anything in. Yeah, because they don't care about a retirement plan. You gave it to them because you thought they should have it. They would just take the extra cash. Just give them what they want. You know? Well, no, because you should want to set up your... No, that's you trying to impose your values on them again. Right? And so there's a reality here. And the reality is that, let's say you started from grassroots start to wherever you land, 700,000, million, 3 million, 5, 10, 20, whatever it is. Only one third of the people who started with you or in the early stage are going to make it to the end.
Hmm.
And you're like, oh man, that's so sad because they put in all that blood, sweat, and tears, you know, to help us get off the ground. Well, guess what? You know where they went when they left you? They went right back to a company who was in that same stage because that's where they like to be. They don't want to be in a professionally managed business. Mm. They don't want predictability in their job. They don't want an SOP hanging over their workstation where that they have to follow. They like it where they wear multiple hats and do things and they're a generalist. They like that. And then you get people who are in that midpoint where it's somewhat structured, but you still get access to the family and the owners, and they kind of like that because it's somewhat structured, but it feels like a family. Well, I got to tell you,
high-performing enterprise-level clients are not families. They are professional sports teams where it's merit-based first and culture second, right? What do they say in sports? Winning cures all the arguments in the locker room.
Sure does.
Winning generates culture. And it's true. Like, if you try to, now, if you want a winning team, the first thing you do is you set the standards and then you hire to the standards. You draw a line and you say, we're going to live above the line.
Mm-hmm.
That means our margin is over this, our, you know, our revenue is over that, our net promoter score is over this. And we have all our metrics above the line. And if you can contribute to them being above the line, rest assured you got a job next year. If your particular part of the business is below the line, yes, you should be worried. And it's just the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're going to, when you go through these different stages of development, you're going to have different kind of employees, you know? So you, if you're in a small business, you're a $5 million company, and you hire somebody who's a CEO from a $100 million plus company, they will struggle because they're used to having all this support system around them, and they're not used to rolling up their sleeves and making their own phone calls and going out and meeting with a client or going in the back and filling the truck and taking the drum over and delivering it somewhere. Yeah. They're not used to doing that, right? And then you take somebody who's run small businesses and the business gets bigger, and what are they doing? They're running around doing everything, and they have a whole team of people sitting waiting for instruction that they never get, you know? And so just understand that as an owner, not everybody's going to come with you, and they don't want to. So stop trying to drag them along. Get used to this, right? I know it's hard, Ed, you and I talked about this. It's a hard expression to say as an owner. You don't like to say it, but when somebody's giving you the, I think it's time to go, just say this: I accept your resignation. I accept your, and like some of them out there are like, no, take it up. All right. Just let them go. They don't want to be here. And they probably stayed longer because they're loyal, but they're miserable.
Yeah.
Let them go. Tell them we're a better company for you being here. Let's stay friends. I'll still invite you over for Thanksgiving. You can come to the company picnic, but let's go. Well, we've got to get you another job somewhere else because you hate it here, you know? And they'll be all the happier. But just have the expectation that people are going to serve you for a window of time. They are not going to serve you after that, and then it's time to move on. I know it's hard because you build trust, relationship, and loyalty, all that, and that's all still present, but they're just not right for the job, and they don't want to be there.
Yeah, that's great. That's great advice. That truly is. Speaking of letting go, you've probably seen this too, but I'd love to hear your perspectives. So you're in a family business dynamic, and there's the founder, right? And sometimes, speaking of letting go, the founder has a real hard time stepping back, letting go, letting that next generation truly come into power, because over that span of years, you know, what's happened? Well, they've gotten really good at the business. The business has been really good to them. And along the way, their identity is now very much hitched to that business. So, you know, I've seen this a number of times. You may have too. You see a very successful CEO sells and exits a business for a very high multiple. Yeah. By all indications, they should be the happiest person alive. Yet what are they? They're miserable. They're depressed. Right? Yeah. Like, because with that sale went their identity. So when you see that, especially in that family dynamic where you've got that founder who's still around, but maybe shouldn't be,
right,
but just can't seem to let go, how do you help that situation where there's another generation poised to take over, ready to take over, ready to take over, but the founder's still kind of floating around? Like, what do you do with that?
Hanging around, sticking their nose in where they don't belong, undermining the kids. Yeah, I've seen that plenty of times. One of the things I learned very early on in my coaching training, when I started out my career as a life coach, one of the first things that we learned was the two top areas of distress you will deal with a client is, number two is, I have a goal, I know what the goal is, I just don't know how to get there, you know, and I need help, and I lack the strategy, and, you know, maybe the education or the attributes, or is there something that's missing? Help me fill the blanks, and that's the number two distress. The number one distress is answering the question, now what? So I've hit my goals, I've gotten the things that I set out to get, but I now don't know what to do with myself. That's the number one distress. And so
we need to step back from the business for a moment and create their life plan. Because the business, like you said, is tied to their identity. It's tied to their feeling of self-worth.
Yep.
What do you need me for now?
Yeah.
Well, in the business, maybe nothing. Or in the business, maybe just your insights and your history, some legacy knowledge. But no, we don't need you for the business. Why? Not because you're not needed. It's because you trained us really well. And we know what to do because you told us. So it's now time to allow us, through your mentorship and your guidance, now assume the role you've groomed us for all of these years. And so it is vitally important. And you don't wait until you sell, but a lot of people do, unfortunately. You know, there's no seminar you can go to that says, all right, what do I do when I get all my goals? All the seminars are how to get my goals. How do I pursue a goal? Well, nobody told you what to do when you get them.
Good point.
How many times? The easiest way to see this is you see it in sport every single day. It won't matter. Pick your sport. One team gets out to a big lead, and then what happens? And then I go into the prevent defense, or I get complacent, or I put in the wrong people because no one told you what to do with a big lead. And then the announcers are like, are they going to pull their players? We should rest them now. No, you keep doing what got you the lead when you have a lead. Because if you do that, your lead will expand, and then no one will catch you. But what do? They forget themselves when they get the lead, and the other team catches right up, and you're like, how did they let that happen? I mean, it happens every day, because there's no class to what do you do when I get my goals? So what we like to do is you with your enterprise plan and your business plan, we say let's create a life plan.
Mm.
And what are your pursuits? What are your missions? What are the things that you want in life that are bigger than you, bigger than the business, that'll still serve the community, that'll still be stimulating, that'll still be challenging, you can attach to your worth, self-worth, not just net worth, and you can be a viable, contributing part of the community. And look, it's necessary. I think going back, probably our parents' generation was work to 65, retire, take it easy, and travel. That's long gone, and everyone's learned that if you retire and do nothing, within, I think it's 3 to 5 years, you're dead broke and dead, or dead, right? Everyone's learned there's no such thing. You can't retire your body. You can't retire your mind. You need to be doing something that is meaningful, stimulating, and challenging, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hanging around your business, that's not challenging. That's again, going back to comfort and going back to familiarity. That's the time to be the CEO of a charity. That's the time to go contribute back to your church or your synagogue or your faith organization. That's the time to go on the board of your HOA. Right? And that's the time to run for city council or go start another business. But don't be in that one. Your time has passed there, and let's find the next challenge for you.
I think that's very incredible advice, because not only for that CEO, but also for that next generation. Because if that next generation operates with the belief or feeling that my mom or my dad, whomever the previous generation is always going to be around. They're always going to be that backstop. They're always going to bail me out of trouble. What am I not learning? I'm not really learning how to lead without them. One day, they're going to be gone. And it's a heck of a thing to discover at maybe 40 or 50 years old that, oh my gosh, I don't have the skills to do this without mom or dad.
Look, it's scary because you lose the two people who knew you your whole life.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what you may think of them, there's only a couple people that have known you your whole life, and
Yeah.
So it's a legitimate fear that I don't know what to do. I remember, for those of you that have had kids, you'll relate to this. I remember the first day taking our daughter home from the hospital. Like, we had nurses and doctors all over us, and then they put you in the car, and you get home, and you're looking around, and you're like, nobody care about us. Like, what's this whole parent thing? Like, that little thing in the swaddled in the blanket looks like it needs us, and we're clueless, right?
So, I was clueless times too. We had twins, so yeah.
Oh, my goodness! Oh, wow! Woo. All right, game on! Double trouble. Two most unqualified people in every business at any given time are the following: number one is the person who just got a promotion.
because the skill set that got them the promotion isn't the skill set you need in the new role. So for a period of time, you're not qualified for the role you have. It's your job to close the gap and get the credentials and experience, get the runs on the board, get the wins you need so you can integrate into the position. The second unqualified person is the CEO of a growing business, right? Again, for a period of time. So let's say your business does $1 million right now. And then all of a sudden you land that big contract or you know, a few things go your way and now you're at $3 million. Well, what qualifies you to run a $3 million business if you've never done it before? Let me assist. Nothing. You're not qualified for it. You need to say, because your problem, you have $3 million problems, $3 million opportunities, $3 million management systems you need in place, $3 million financial strategies, $3 million banking relationships. You need $3 million of everything. And you know 1 million, you don't know 3 million. So there's a gap. There's a time gap, and it's your job as the CEO to be constantly filling that gap as quickly as possible. Mm. So the person who just got the promotion, it's a short period of time that they're unqualified. 90 to 180 days, they grow into the role, they're pretty good. The CEO of a growing business, though, you live there.
Mm.
You live there, right? So you have to be, this is why planning in advance is so important, because if your pro forma or your projection says, well, we're at 5 million right now, I think we're going to be at 8 by the end of the year. Well, I hope you're working on your personal development and your professional development, your leadership development, so you grow at the same pace, if not greater than or faster than the business, because when 8 million arrives, you better arrive as an $8 million leader, right? And so that's where the challenge comes in, is that You're constantly being stressed, and you can do this CEO gig or this founder gig two ways. One is you can try to keep up, or the other way is you can get ahead of it and always be improving. So that you are running side by side with the business itself, and consequently leading it there.
Mm. Great, really great point. Thank you so much, Carl. I feel like we could talk for days. But do have to wrap up here. But this has been a great discussion. So I want one more question. You brought forward so many points. I know that online you have many great resources available to people that would want to learn more about you and the work that you do. But if we could ask, if one of our listeners wanted to learn more about you, connect with you, or learn more about the work you do at Seven Stage Advisors, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah, great. So the easiest way to reach me is on my personal site called Carl360.com, Carl360.com, the number 360. So Carl360.com, go there and just hit me up there. Just let me know that you saw the podcast. And as a gift to your listeners, we'll do what we call a free business analysis. In other words, it's a 2-hour in-depth consultation. We take you through a 4-page process where we have a formula that shows you how much money you're leaving on the table in your current business model based on how it's being run. So let's say you're a $5 million business. We'll show you that you're really an $8 million business underperforming the $5 million. And we have a very specific formula. We'll take you through that, and you can see where you should be spending your time and effort and energy to grow the business and get it back up to its potential.
Awesome. That's very kind of you. So, Carl, thank you so much for such a great conversation, your thoughtful perspectives, your insights about how growth really works, and the real pragmatic truths about growth and what it means and what it doesn't mean, especially when business leadership and family dynamics are all in the mix.
Yeah.
Your insights really reinforce that, you know, scaling a company is rarely just a strategy issue. It's a lot more to it and a lot more to consider. So again, we've been speaking with Carl Gold of Seven Stage Advisors, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Carl, thanks again for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning in to Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeLeaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.